Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patty LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
There's a cat over here. There's a cat over there. And the wrong one died. And the wrong one died.
Welcome to The Wrong Cat Died, a podcast breakdown of the catastrophe. I'm your host, Mike Abrams, and today we have another amazing guest. He was a swing on the fifth national tour, U.S. national tour of Cats in 2009, and you can currently see him in the ensemble of Spamalot, which is a hilarious show I highly recommend seeing if you are in New York. So welcome, Michael Fatica, and thank you for joining me.
My gosh, thank you for having me. I'm so excited to talk about Cats.
Cats and Spamalot, the duo I never thought, you know, besides Maria, I didn't think we were going to get that deep into this, but I love that there's kittens all over the Spamalot crew here for you all. But let's start at the beginning. I always got to start at the beginning. So you saw this in, you went on in 2009. So like, I think right after school, you said, before we were chatting, but when was the first time you actually saw the show?
You know, I remember watching them. I have a very visceral memory of watching the filmed version, that original movie version that we all saw growing up in my loft in my hometown. I don't remember if it was high school or college, but it was definitely sometime in my teens. And I remember watching it about 30 minutes in, sort of taking a break to get some food, coming back, returning to it, being a bit confused by it. And I didn't experience the movement of it until I was in college. There was an alumni of my college. I went to Florida State University. An alumni had been on the national tour, I think in 2003, and they rolled through Florida. So he came and did a masterclass with us.
Oh, cool.
And he taught us a bit of the Jellicle Ball, and I loved the movement of it. So then my classmates and I all got together and watched it, possibly under the influence of some special beverages one might have in college. And we watched the whole thing and geeked out. And that's where my love for Cats began.
That probably made it so much better, is to watch it with a college influence. And, you know, that's, I agree, because I didn't see it growing up. I didn't see it until I was after the show really started. I never watched it. And so hearing that a group got together, had a little rowdy Rocky Horror style show, which is what I thought the 2019 movie needed to turn into. But so you obviously didn't get to do it. You really are introduced to it, not like super young as a kid where it was like part of your dance class, but in this master class at Florida State. And then you right after college book.
Yeah. So a lot of times from Florida State, some students will fly up. I'm sure this is true for every college, but we would fly up to New York if there was an audition for a national tour, something that might provide some longevity. And a few of us went for a weekend. I think we did the Hairspray National Tour and the Cats National Tour, probably April 2009. And yeah, I was luckily cast as a swing. So I swung for four roles, the kittens. This is for Mistopheles, for Mungo Jerry, Tumble Brutus, and Pouncival. I'm sure you've probably have talked about this a million times on the podcast, but you know, the original version of casting the show, they will do like a swing will cover sort of the short people or the tall people or the little gods, the small ones. So I'm 5'6", so I'm slotted right into the sort of kitten swing.
Okay. So when you get the role, and I'm fascinated by swings, just blow my mind to begin with, but I'm fascinated by on this tour, which had been going on for a while at that point, right? Like this is a refreshing year after year. How much as a swing are they telling you of story and arc and everything you need to know about all the characters you're going with?
Oh, okay. Well, they really put you through the full process and the full ringer. I'm very thankful for this actually, because I approach musicals sort of from an actor's perspective. I've done a lot of heavy musicals, but I think it's such a treat when you get to play a character from the top of the show to the end of the show.
Yeah.
And you do that in Cats. You're playing one of these characters. Maybe there's a step out or so, but most of the time you're a character throughout. So you actually get a beginning, middle, and end. And we rehearsed, I think, for a week or so with only the new Cats. I think there were probably nine of us that were new to this tour, and the rest were all returning. And those who were swinging, we focused on one character. So I started learning Mistopheles first. And I did his track throughout the full rehearsal process. So I was ready to go for Mistopheles by our second or third week. And Richard Stafford was the director who was teaching us the show, who has been an alumni of Cats on Broadway, tours. He's done it for years and years and years. So we talk about all the interpersonal relationships between the cats. We'd start every day with Felinity, which I don't know if you've spoken about yet, but it's essentially 30 minutes of crawling around on the floor doing cat improv.
Just being a cat.
Learning. Yeah, you kind of learn how your body moves as a cat, as a dancer, as an actor. He would do exercises, for instance, saying, if you're a cat who feels they have power in the tribe, stand up. Or if you're a cat who feels that they're scared of confrontation, hide in the corner. And sort of, you can learn your cat's like hierarchy within the tribe. We really went right into the story of it all, which I think made it really special coming from college, because college actors are just immersed in like the art and learning and trying to like express themselves. It's not quite become a job yet in the sense of like, oh, I have to make money and have to do this. So for an experience right out of college, it felt so fresh and so exactly where my mind was. I wonder if I was to do it now, whether I would roll my eyes at Felinity practice. But at the time, I was like telling everybody and so psyched about learning how to be a cat.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think like the idea of Felinity is wild in itself. But then when you think about your job in general, it's not like, I want to say not the norm, because what job is the norm, but it's so different than a lot of people's work. And so to be able to say like, I'm going to go spend 30 minutes, an hour just learning how to be a cat, to then be able to go be a cat on stage for 2.5-3 hours is just not the world most people live in. But I think it's such a cool part of what you all do. So I want to hear a little bit about, you said that you started as Mistopheles, and you obviously have this like spoken truth of what we know is told to you by Richard or whoever, but then you have to kind of add to it. So do you remember what kind of conversations you and your 9 new cast members, or just the cast in general, had about adding to the backstories? Like, what was told versus what did you add as an influence?
That's a great question. I think for Mistopheles, we understand that he has magical powers in some way. Mm-hmm. And there's sort of magic that's glittered over the whole arc of the show. Obviously, you're invented with the fact that these cats can sing and speak and do all these things that cats can't normally do. So in terms of the magic of Mistopheles, they just sort of, they give you the premise that the fact that he can do special things, but they don't tell you how or why. So we definitely were speaking about like, okay, what do cats do normally that feel magical? Like when a cat can fall from a second story floor and land on their feet, like that has to, it doesn't feel like something that I as a human could do or can fathom how to twist my body in order to do that. So we did definitely play with like, where does the magic come from? How do you physicalize that? Like what, you know, is it real magic? Are the cats just all like hyped up on themselves and they can't imagine it? I think most of the thing that we invent in ourselves though, were the relationships. Like, you know, we know that Mistopheles and Skimbleshanks are sort of older and wiser cats and they have a little bit of history with the club. But, you know, I remember our Skimbleshanks and I were really close friends. So we would say like, okay, these two were born in the same corner and we, you know, went to the same alleyways to steal food, go to the same bodegas. We like maybe lived with a family, you know, we all make up little stories with ourselves. But I think that what they gave us were the things on the paper in terms of who knows who and who knows, you know, who's been attacked by who slept with who likes who. But, you know, we definitely created plenty of little backstories.
Okay. So what was let's go into that. What were the told relationships as you have to play these no matter what? And then what were some of the fun ones that you all, that doesn't really change the plot, but you kind of added?
Well, we definitely, I mean, things we know are like, you know, McCavity has had relationships with a lot of the women. So like Meter, he's, you know, probably had relationships with her that were not something that she wanted, or Mom Ballerina. And we know that Tumble Brutus takes Victoria's virginity during the Jellicle Ball, like things like that. A lot of the teenage stuff, but you know, it was more, honestly, it was more the boys who would have fun with this, but we'd say like Mistopheles and Pouncival may have been dating, or like we said, like, I think Skimbleshanks was like, maybe Tumble Brutus is Skimbleshanks' son, but he's ashamed of him, so he doesn't speak to him.
Wow. Okay.
I think Coraline, the little kitten girls, were all pretended they were like the mean girls from like Regina George's gang. I think they had like Victoria and Syllabub and Rumpelteazer were like Katie and Regina. I mean, it was just like they were like a little girl clique that we because they're together a lot in the show, so they would like act out against the other cats and stuff just to sort of do
okay, so funny. So I've heard some of those. I've definitely heard the Tumblebirds and Skimbleshanks. But yes. Wait, hold on. We got to go a little deeper into that Mean Girls one. So who are the Mean Girls and how do we rank this one?
I think it was Syllabub, Rumpelteazer, and Victoria. And Victoria was the Regina George, and Rumpelteazer was Gretchen Wieners, and Syllabub was Katie Heron.
Okay, so I've got Syllabub is Katie. And then you said Victoria was Regina?
Victoria was Regina George, yeah. Because she's secretly a mean girl.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and then she has her turnaround. Redemption at the end. So that's kind of like her getting hit by the bus, and then she comes back. Okay, and then you said Rumpelteazer is Gretchen. I have not heard
that. Rumpelteazer is pretty annoying.
Yeah. I have not heard that one. I love that as just being able to have the three of them as the plastics kind of roaming around the stage all night and then wreaking havoc. It does fit. I mean, it really does kind of work. That's fun. So the three of them are together, and then is there a way to expand that? Who's Aaron Samuels in that situation?
I mean, probably Tumble Brutus, right? Because he gets with Victoria.
I guess it's true. Okay. I've not thought Mean Girls through on this, but now my head's spinning on the ways to cast cats as Mean Girls. Because we're going to cast cats in the Spamalot later. We're getting there eventually.
Oh, my God.
So I think one thing that's interesting is I know you mentioned when we were chatting before that you actually only did a portion of the year. Because usually, you know, the tour, you do like a one-year contract, but you only did a few months of As a Swing. So tell a little bit about what that scenario was like and how you kind of, I guess, really prepared for this role, but then also knowing it was a shorter contract than what most of these year-long tours would be.
Yeah, so I had been cast in this national tour probably April 2029, or 20, not 2029, I wish, 2009, as a youth. And then through my senior showcase that spring, I'd been cast as LeFou in the Beauty and the Beast national tour that was starting. This, you know, we have a joke in New York that every road leads back to either the Beauty and the Beast national tour or the Cats national tour. Because everyone has done one of them. There's like a network of people that have splayed throughout these shows. But I knew that was starting in January, and we started Cats rehearsals the end of August. So it was really only a few months. But it was such a cool time because we only did a month in the US. We did, I think, like a week in Chicago, a week in Orlando, maybe a week in New Orleans. Oh, and we did go to Reno because my wallet was stolen in Reno and I'll never. And then we went to South and Central America. So we did like Colombia, Venezuela, Costa Rica, Panama. And then I left the week after we got back. And I didn't tell anybody because I didn't really understand the way it works yet. I didn't really know about when to put notice in. So I just completely kept my mouth shut until my 4 weeks before when I could give my notice. And then I told everybody all at once. So I had this sort of dark secret looming. But because I knew it was a short amount of time, I feel like I took advantage of it. And As a Swing, they were really lucky. We were really lucky that they swung us on early. So I had done Mistopheles the first week of the run. And then the second week of the run, I did Muggle Jerry. So they really tossed us in. So I had performed all the roles multiple times. And, you know, the show is about a tribe, and it's about this, like, this sort of gang of cats in a really positive way, actually. They bonded together and they're surviving. So our group that we did it with, first of all, there was probably, of the returnees, probably 8 or 9 of them were like, had done it for years and loved the show. So they came in with this like real tribe mentality. So the cast was really close, and the cast was real. We also were secluded in South and Central America together. So we really had to bond together and move around as a group. So it really was a really tight knit group of people that were jumping into the show in sort of foreign language countries. And, in terms of preparation, I didn't know what I was getting into. I'd never swung. And I didn't know a whole lot about the show aside from having watched the film.
What do you remember of that viewing with your Florida State-ing?
I think we remember being really confused and not having a whole lot of idea of what the plot was about. But anytime someone got a solo, I do remember us assigning who we thought from our musical theater program would be best for these solos. And joking about those things. But the preparation for the show, I think really it was, I went in with just like as a sponge, like scared and confused and worried about what I was going to do. But because they taught us one track at a time, it was really not that overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And I now know that I have sort of a brain for swinging and I'm able to do it. But at the time I was just sort of like, who knows? It's a job. I'll do my best. And I think we were just so lucky that the group was so supportive and loved Cats so much that if you could really drink the Kool-Aid, and it was sort of welcomed by the group.
Yeah. Swinging takes is a skill set. I feel like you have to it takes a set of, your brain has to function a certain way to do. Like, it's definitely different. And with Cats, it is one of those things where I hear this frequently, that for the most part, because it's a tribe mentality, the show's already about community. And especially on tour, when you're on the road and you're in city after city after city and don't know many other people, you're kind of forced to become, you know, friends and family quickly. And then I also kind of have joked, you're also crawling on top of each other in unitards the whole time. So like, you have to get comfortable with each other quickly because of the force of the show just kind of makes you do it. And so I've heard that, I think, more frequently than I've heard with some other shows. Now, again, I'm not a performer. I don't know if the Beauty and the Beast tour feels the same way, or if the Chorus Line tour or whatever these other tours that go out have that same vibe. But it seems like it is disproportionately high in Cats because of the nature of the show.
I think you're right. I think we had also a lot of tormances on our Cats mm-hmm. tour, myself included. I think you're right that the nature of being in a unitard backstage crawling around on each other sort of frees you emotionally and physically with each other. There's sort of no boundaries. So I think you are right that you get closer because of that. It definitely was different than the Beauty and the Beast tour, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. There was a real separation in terms of how comfortable we were with each other.
Yeah. I want to hear a little bit about the reactions of just being in South America, South and Central America, because this is a tour at that point had gone on for many years and had gone around the U.S. kind of over and over and over again. And now you're entering a new place that's super unfamiliar, probably different language in a lot of cases. And from what I've heard, though, every time that tour goes down there or the stage of production, the crowds are just crazy and wild and fun and like really loving it. So what do you remember of that? And what kind of fun tour stories do you have?
Well, I think you're right that Cats doesn't need to be viewed, I don't think, by English speaking audiences at all times, because to be quite honest, it's poetry. And for, unless you're someone who's familiar with it ahead of time, a lot of times you don't know what's going on either way. You're just sort of getting the emotion or the vibe from watching something. And that's, it's sort of brilliantly choreographed in that way that you understand sort of what's happening without having to listen a lot of times. So it sort of reads well for foreign language audiences. And I also think in South Central America, a lot of those people do speak English. So they're come in with some sort of like, a bit of background as to what they're saying, but it doesn't really matter. But people loved, we were in like these sort of like arena type spaces. I think we had a theater in one of the cities. I can't remember which, but the other ones were sort of like, they moved the basketball hoops and the bleachers and made like a space in the stage for us, which does happen a lot in these non-union tours. But that just means also there's a ton of people there. So there, I remember there just being huge crowds. And the downbeat of the music, people are screaming, but probably more drinking than was going on in the, you know, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, if you go through or something, it's like a small US city. But yeah, people were super receptive. There was opening night parties every time. There was red carpets. It was a whole to do anytime we would get to a city where it's not quite as popular in the US city as you go to. A lot of times it's a subscription series that people are just showing up because that's Wednesday and they have their tickets purchased months ago. So this was, the people were really excited for the show to come when we were there. And the cities are, you know, back in 2009, you know, Venezuela was not super safe to visit. So mm-hmm. we would like be kind of escorted from the theater to the hotel and back and forth by sort of people who were working for the company. I don't really actually remember where their connection. We would like get in a van to go places. If we were to get out of the hotel, we sort of had to be escorted, or you have to go on like a sanctioned bike tour or something, because to just stroll around Venezuela was not really recommended at that time. So I remember getting there and feeling a little depressed by the situation and feeling just like overwhelmed by that first city. Although Caracas is absolutely beautiful. So you're in this place that's like incredibly beautiful to see, and then you feel a little like you can't explore as much as you want.
Mm-hmm.
But when we got to Colombia, we went to two cities in Colombia and then Costa Rica, it really became a little easier. So I remember spending every moment we could at a beach or at like a historical site or some sort of like museum tour. Like we really took advantage of these cities. And then the bonus is the swing is you can run around all day. And if you're not on the show that night, you can kind of rest at night. So sometimes you're like, okay, well, I'm not doing it tonight. So I'm going to take a 25-mile bike tour and then ice my legs all night at
the
show. And
pray you don't get called in. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Yeah. I mean, I was trying to think time wise about 2009 and the safety and all that with those different cities. But at the same time, just being internationally, like it's not Tallahassee, it's not New York. Like it's a different place to be able to really immerse yourself in culture and get to experience new things while you're again, young, you have a different time. Like your work is at night for the most part. So you have this like much more freedom during the day, as long as if you're on, you've got to be ready to go. But again, a different allows you to go to a museum or a historical site a little easier than if you're working 9 to 5 and then you've got to try to go after. So pretty cool to be able to do that. And then I can imagine that crowds were crazy. I've heard these arenas are there, but did you run into any issues or any fun scenarios if you did Green Eyes with that much drinking in that big of a place?
We had some rules for Green Eyes. I remember that, you know, in the US, you can get up in people's faces. I remember I used to like take people's purses and then give them back and like, you know, just sort of be playful with these people. But we were sort of told to keep like a body's length from actually crunching audience members. Just, I think because the company was sort of unsure as to how people would react. But I have to say, I feel like it was the opposite. We would show up with those green eyes and people would stand up and clap for us. They would like want to dance with us because they thought it was sort of like an immersive party. Whereas people in the US, I think, are a little more guarded about audience participation. So Green Eyes was fun because you could really go out and get involved with people without touching them. But we would really like get something back from them, which was cool.
Yeah.
I remember one lady like tried to follow us backstage and we were like, no, you can't. And then she didn't really understand what we're saying. So somebody had to come and like tell her to go back to her seat. But she was, you know, I think she thought she was like, oh, I'm an audience plant. I get to be taken on stage. But we couldn't really communicate that to her. Yeah, but it was. I felt like they were really receptive to those kind of things.
Yeah.
That's, we also had script titles over the show. So the, you know, it was being broadcast to them in whatever language.
Okay.
Was spoken. It was all back there, but yeah, it was all super titled. So they could read what was going on as well. So there was a little bit of connection to the story.
I know they've done, translated versions of it because I've talked to people on tour in Mexico or quote unquote tour. In Mexico, where they translate the names and the songs and the whole thing was in Spanish. And it's a slightly different. It's like comically different when you like hear the names because there's not, they, you know, some of the names don't translate, but they did attempt to do it and it's kind of fun. So you did the English version, but just in these other cities with like the opera, you've got to read some of it if you're not sure. But yeah. I do think to your point, it's hard to follow the plot if you speak the language. And so it's more about the visual and the experience and the singing that you don't really need to know what they're saying. I mean, Skimbleshanks's train story isn't going to help you figure out why you need to hear Skimbleshanks's train story.
Exactly.
We're going to take a quick break and then we'll be back for more of The Wrong Cat Died.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Okay. I want to pivot. I want to talk about Spamalot because I've now seen it twice. And I saw it like 3 days apart. But I had a blast. It's the funniest thing. It's so well done. I want to cast Spamalot into Cats in a minute, but I want to hear a little bit about like your experience being in this show on Broadway. You know, you're playing a million different kind of characters throughout and kind of in the ensemble and dancing all kinds of fun numbers. But tell a little bit about like what can an audience member expect to see and what you've loved about it so far.
Spamalot is great. It's exactly what you said. It's great fun. I think that's sort of the overarching theme of it. It is we're not telling a heavy story. We're sort of telling a story that's really about finding yourself and accepting the things that are great about yourself. And it is so lighthearted, and it feels a little like camp where we go and there's just a bunch of like titans of comedy who come and are constantly trying to one-up each other and play with each other. And it always feels like once the downbeat of music starts, whatever day you were having, it kind of goes away with Spamalot. And that is such a treat. You know, I had been performing on Broadway since 2012 and have really, once the pandemic hit, I really pivoted to doing more creative projects. I've been working as an associate choreographer and doing my own choreography jobs. And that sort of had been what I'd been doing full time and had hung up my dancing shoes. So when this came around, it was just going to be a 10 show production at the Kennedy Center. So I had said yes to it because it was a great group and I knew the creative team, and I was excited to sort of have, like, you know, a fun experience in a bit of time off that I had. So when it was coming to Broadway, I remember having a lot of reservations saying it's always such a treat when you're able to be offered a Broadway show that is you know, is going to be fun and you know is going to be easy. And it is also like intended as a limited run at the moment. So it is, you know, not a lifetime commitment in a lot of ways. So I had a lot of like mental hurdles of like, do I want to do this? Do I want to perform again? Do I want to step into this world? Because the schedule is a beast. It's different than my partner who doesn't work in the theater business, all sorts of things that contribute to it. But every day I'm thankful for having done this because it is such a silly, wonderful group of people. And the whole point of it is to make an audience laugh. And it makes us laugh. It makes them laugh. You leave at 10:30 at night feeling energized and excited. So I think like it's been a really positive experience all around.
Yeah, you do have an incredible cast. And I think you could, at least the both times I saw Alex Reiman's first night, and it looked like he was just intending, like, how can I get somebody to break? Like, how can I do this so ridiculous? And I know they improvise a couple sections where it's like, what over the top section can I do? And it felt like that over and over because everyone's so talented that there's this like really great chemistry, but also this like, are we going to be able to hold it together when these moments happen?
Well, a lot of the principal cast did not get to rehearse with Alex. Any of the new principal cast who was in the show when Alex joined again, because he had done the show at the Kennedy Center and then was doing another show once we opened. So Taryn Killam came in for the first few months, who is also absolutely wonderful. Taryn is a dad, and he's I think he kind of leans in the world of like dad jokes, and all of his villainous characters kind of were all on the kinder side. And Alex is different than that. I think he's a performer. He's biting and he likes to sort of lean on the darker side of jokes. And obviously he comes from the Beetlejuice world, which is so dark in a lot of ways. That it was fun to watch the reactions of the principals who didn't know him, seeing his approach to these. And a lot of times he'll take a joke directly at them and try to break, not try to break them, but, you know, try to include them. And it was kind of a fun few weeks of watching them like learn how Alex does it.
Yeah.
Because we do put in rehearsals with mostly understudies, and then they get one go with him and then they do the show with him. So it's kind of fun to see it through their eyes.
Yeah. Especially with those moments that are, you know, they are slightly improvised. I think there's a couple of improvised sections that changes every night. And I've always been curious, like, how much do they have any heads up of what he's doing? Or does he not give any heads up to them? And it's just going to say, nope, we're going with this today. And it's a complete free for all.
Yeah. Alex does not give them a heads up. I think James Iglehart, who is really the brunt of it during the Knights of Knee section. For those who don't know the show, the Knight of Knee comes out and he announces his name, and it's repeated many times. And then at the end of his bit, he says, no, we're no longer the Knights Who Need to Say Knee, we are, and then creates a new name. And Alex he goes on a different tangent every night. It could be a jingle, it could be a popular song, it could just be a made-up conversation that he's had with himself. Since, like, the other day, he called his mom from prison, saying he had been in, like, a drunk driving incident. And, like, he'll invent it every night, and James then has to repeat whatever he says. My favorite nights are when he picks something that James does not know. I bet James will sometimes attempt it, but most of the time we'll just clap back and say, you know, I don't know what that is. The other day, Alex did the Calteen bar speech from Mean Girls, because Jonathan Bennett has not joined the show, who is the original Aaron Samuels from Mean Girls. So he does the whole conversation with Regina and Katie saying, like, oh, why are you eating a Calteen bar? I gain weight through that. And James then had to admit that he'd never seen the movie on stage with Aaron Samuel.
That's
so no,
great.
not a lot of heads up given. Same with Leslie Kritzer. She has this section during Knights of the Round Table where she has kind of no holds barred. She can do whatever she wants. There are some mile markers for the musicians to know when she's going to start singing again, but most of it is, it's just a treat for us to get to watch every night and see what she's going to do. She's nearly called into the pit a few times this past week, so she's really getting crazy.
I was going to say, I think she sang Britney Spears when I saw that section, and then the two times I saw Alex did Hey Jude and on his first night, and I loved because he stopped and was like, no, you didn't finish, when James Michael didn't actually get to the point. And then I think he did the 1-800 Cars for Kids jingle the second time I was there. So it's pretty fun to, I can only imagine him thinking these things up as he's getting ready to go.
Well, Alex Brightman is a well of creativity. There is never an end for him in terms of what he's going to pull out of the back. Same for a lot of these people. But specifically in that section, I feel like he'll never repeat. He's like, there's always something in that strange little brain of his to pull out.
I love it. All right, let's cast the Spamalot cast into Cats. So I've thought a little bit about this. I did not give you a heads up that this was coming, so we're gonna do this on the fly. So let's start with King Arthur. So who would you think is, which cat would be King Arthur?
I think he's probably he's like a healthy mixture of Old Deuteronomy and Monkustrap, right? Like he's the king. He's got this reverence that we all respect of his, but he's a little bit more, I feel like he's more of an active leader maybe than Old Deuteronomy, but I guess if I had to pick one, I'd say Old Dude.
So that's who I picked, because I do have Monkustrap as another choice.
Okay.
So I did have him as Old Dude. Felt kind of right. That one was one of the easier ones, I think. Sir Robin.
Okay. Well, he's scared of everything, so maybe he's Demeter?
That's exactly what I wrote. I was like, we gotta ditch genders here and just go, because they're cats.
Right.
Like, who's skittish? Who's scared of everything? And I wrote down Demeter.
Okay.
We're on the same page so far. Sir Lancelot.
I mean, Sir Lancelot, is that Monkustrap probably?
That's not who I had. I have Monkustrap later, coming soon. And okay, I think you'll get it right when I say it too. You'll recognize why.
Okay. Well, he has a long journey, right? So he joins as a knight. He's like overly brave. He's overly like cocky, and then at the end of the day we learn that he's gay, so maybe that's
you just described exactly the can I wrote down for that exact reason.
Simple Shades.
I wrote down Tugger.
Oh, you're right, that is Robson Tugger.
Overconfident, super cocky, very fluid, I think you find out. So that I had it as Tugger. I was waiting for the end where he comes out to be, you know, Mistopheles was there for him and ready. That one seemed obvious to me, so I'm glad that we're here. Lady of the Lake.
I feel like she is Grizabella, but in the time between when she left the tribe and before she got old and grizzly and came back, when she was in her heyday.
Yeah, that's why I had Grizabella belts it out, but earlier, like not the what we see in the ball.
Yeah.
This one was hard. Patsy.
I'd say maybe he could be a little Gus the theater cat, because he's a little bit of an Eeyore. But maybe I actually feel like he's probably Skimbleshanks. And I say this because he's everybody's bud. He's always hyping up Old Dude. He's always there for him. And like, I feel like we always joke that Skimbleshanks is like the uncle cat.
Yeah.
So maybe I would say Skimble. What do you think?
I had Joey Lorem, just because I kept thinking, if you're taking care of Gus, you're kind of that caretaker. Yeah. Patsy's kind of always there, really taking care of everything. So that was kind of the one where I was like, that was my rationale. But I do see the Skimbleshanks combination here for that.
Okay. I see yours as well.
Okay. Historian. Now, Historian plays like a billion characters, but I picked it based on the Historian aspect of the show.
Okay. Well, the Historian himself, I would say then, actually, I take my former answer. He would be Skimbleshanks for me. I just said everybody's been Skimbleshanks.
I had this as Monkustrap. This is my narrator who's telling everything that's going on. So this is where I stuck Monkustrap instead of for King Arthur.
I'm really taking his full arc of his track, though, and I'd say Mistopheles, because he can be any character. He's a bit of a shapeshifter. Like, I'm looking at the whole thing, because he does play 9 characters throughout.
that, so that part's true. And I was even trying to think, do we go with some of the other characters? I was like, let's just stick with the Astoria because that's Mungus Trap.
Okay.
But that's very true. Is like being able to magically change throughout could be very Mephistopheles. This was the last one I have, but the hardest one. You can tell me if there's anybody else you want to add, but Sir Dennis, and this one I had a lot of trouble with.
Well, Sir Dennis, I guess if you're looking at just Dennis, that's before he becomes Galahad. So that's, he's this like teenager who's just got his too many thoughts for his own good. So maybe that's like from the revival. We didn't have this character, but wasn't there Carbuckety?
Yeah, who was like one of the kittens and
the kitten. But I think that was played by this dancer Giuseppe Pasilio. I'm incredibly wrong, but he's like, he was like angsty and like a little bit like, in kind of a Tumble Brutus vibe too, I'd say. Like,
yeah,
kid who just can't keep his emotions together, but he's a little aggressive and bombastic.
I think I looked at this more of the later, the Sir Galahad. I had him as more Bustifer, I think. I don't know why one just kind of
right.
Fit out more. Is there anybody else I've missed that we had a cast?
I don't think so. I think you've got them all.
There's the person who pops up who's not in the show. I thought that was one of
Sir Not Appearing.
I think there's a couple dancers in the opening number that have names and then are gone. And I feel like that was him. That was the other one I have. So that's in the revival. It was Peter, which is my least favorite cat. And Peter's Bus Gus. But in the opening number, they dance and they actually named him Peter. And I know that name has changed a lot for that character. So that felt like that could be the Sir Not in the Show.
I love that.
This was so fun. I love casting these. Okay, let's go to some of the rapid fire now. Let's get to the most important questions here. So if you could go on for one cat, doesn't matter, male, female, whoever, just one night, who would you want to go on for?
My to-go answer is, the or go-to answer is Gimbleshanks the Rattly Cat.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm also old now, so if I had to do cats, I would have to be one of the old cats, because my body physically couldn't do the other ones.
There's the arc. That's the great part about cats. You can do it throughout your career, because you can end That's at right. Gus, start of the kittens, end at Gus, and you're ready to go. Who are your favorite and least favorite cats?
Okay. My favorite cats would, I feel like Mephistopheles would be a great time to hang with.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like Bomb Ballerina would be really fun to hang out with. She's saucy and fun. I think my least favorite cats are, well, McCavity is masochist and he doesn't support women. So get rid of him. Yep. And I'd say probably Syllabub. I'm not one for kids, really. And I feel like Syllabub would maybe get on my nerves.
Yeah. You don't want the Katie Heron of the tribe to be part of your group. Okay.
Left.
Favorite song from the show?
I mean, I will do two. I think like Memory is such a beautiful, wonderful song. I do think it's one of my favorites, but really it's the Jellicle Ball once it gets a da 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 da. I remember like, I feel like my heart rate goes up whenever I hear it because of like, prepping for the show, I used to like run on the treadmill a little bit to sort of get some stamina, just being like, what can I do? And that was one of the things. And I would listen to that on the treadmill. It would always get to that section, just like pump through to the end. And I remember dancing it, just feeling like you're so exhausted by that point. It's just like your body just kicks into muscle memory. And to this day, I listen to that and I feel joy. Also, one little tidbit in Spamalot, there's 2/8 counts during the Broadway number. The Sir Robin's number about how we need Jewish people to do a Broadway show. And there's a 2/8 count break where we can do whatever choreography we want from a Broadway show. And I do the Jellicle Ball.
You do this? That's what you do every night?
Yes.
What a fun little tidbit. I don't think I caught that. I was definitely in that number trying to see all the different shows that kind of you weave into it. So you get to do, I'm gonna have to figure out where that is next. I love
it's,
that.
I think it's the Copeland section. That's the, if you look that up.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. The most infamous part of the ball, exactly. Right? Like that's the one that they teach everybody.
Mm-hmm.
That's super fun. That's cool. I think so. All right. That's a good Easter egg for anybody that goes and sees this show soon. Try to catch Copeland in the Broadway song. All right. Which cat do you think, this is my fun one, which cat do you think would be the best in the Knights of the Round Table?
I think that's a great question. I think probably the boring answer is probably Mungo Strap because, you know, he's a natural leader. He, I think, would probably volunteer himself for battle and go out with them. But really, I guess I think that most addition, we don't really have a villain. So I really might say McCavity.
He
would be happy to jump into battle. I think he would be an addition that we don't have in currently the Knights of the Round Table because they're all sort of good natured.
Yeah. I was thinking similar on the McCavity line, but I didn't think as villainous. So I was thinking it was Monk Jerry. But then I think he probably doesn't actually want to do any of this stuff. He just kind of like is fake mischievous for that moment. So that's how I was thinking for this answer.
Also a great answer.
Okay. And most important question I ask, and the basis for this show is I've argued that I don't think Grisabella is the right Jellicle choice. So I want to hear, are you going to defend Grisabella or are you going to make a different Jellicle choice?
Okay. Well, can I ask you first, what sort of are your qualifications for why someone would go to the Heaviside Lair?
I'm going to spin that back on you because I don't want to influence your decision, but I can give you my thoughts on that after. But I think that's I think that's a critical question to ask is when you think about answering that question.
Okay. So I think if a cat was to be chosen for the Heaviside Lair, it would be, I think it's like a redemption idea. Like this cat has proven that they've either lived a life or they have done something in life that it's time for them to be like reincarnated. I always thought that they went up there and, you know, they come back as another cat or they come back and get another life. I think I'm not going to defend Grisabella because I feel like she got her redemption. I understand that she goes up there, but if I'm to choose someone else, I mean, maybe I'm sure you get this a lot, probably Gus the Theater Cat. Maybe I'll give three and then we can do a vocal choice. So Gus the Theater Cat probably gets a lot because he's proven himself as this cat who's has had his theater career that just didn't like, you know, he's reached the end of it. He's just living in the memories. So maybe let him go and get a new one. And he's the sweetest, I think.
Yeah.
But I might also advocate for like a Demeter who has had all this trauma, right? So maybe she gets to go to the Heaviside Lair to then like start a new life without this sort of like baggage from McCavity. Maybe I hate Syllabub. Maybe that's what I'm realizing in this, but maybe it's like you see Syllabub sort of wanting to be this Grisabella archetype and they say like, no girl, you're already going around the wrong path.
Don't do
it. Up to the Heaviside Lair with you. You get to come back and try again.
Bop, bop. All right.
My strongest argument though is for Demeter.
Okay, so I do keep track. So who's your one vote going to?
It's going to go to Demeter.
Demeter, I love it. It's a different vote. It's not the most common one. I am all for it. So I think to answer your first question is what's the like rationale for the decision? And I think the redemption arc is an interesting piece of this because it's why, you know, it's a story we're told. But I've always kind of challenged it a little bit. In the sense of, is there somebody that needs redemption every year? Like this is an annual process. Is there another Grisabella out there that is going to need it? Is someone going to have a really bad year? And I keep thinking if you're going to do this as an annual tradition and a tribe, is that consistent enough of a reason? And so we're not given answers on this, but I've kind of always thought a little bit is who's the most worthy and needing, which would be less about redemption, but more of about, okay, the needing could be they're almost at the end of their life like Gus. Or your Demeter argument is this baggage is almost too much to handle. Let's let you go up and come back and start fresh and have this fresh. And so there's the biggest need there. And you can make that argument. And I've kind of liked that a little bit more than redemption because I kind of think if you bring Victoria or you bring Grisabella back, who's next year's redemption story? So that's kind of my main one is either need. I also like the idea is Old Deuteronomy might be teaching a lesson each year and it could be a different lesson every year. So this year could be compassion and next year could be redemption and it could be, you know, this. So there's a lot of ways to look at it, but you're only given one. So you have to make your assumptions based off of that.
I love that. I love that with cats, anybody can walk away with literally any story that they want to leave. They can... It's the cool part about this kind of show where like, it's all, you know, it's all up to interpretation. So you can pretend, you know, who everyone has relationships with on stage, or you can just, if you know any of the facts, you can follow them, but it's fun to just leave with whatever theme you've taken. I think that's cool.
I love it. Well, you are the second Demeter vote.
Whoa.
And I'm just going to quickly check here because I'm pretty sure the first Demeter vote was from a Demeter, which is very common for me to get votes for somebody separate. And it's like, oh, no way. Oh, no, it was not. I take that back. It was from Jenny Anydots, who voted for Demeter. It was Eloise Kropp has Demeter as their choice.
Eloise Kropp was in Spamalot at the Kennedy Center, so we are also in the spam town together.
Did y'all talk about this, and this is how this is happening? Okay. I'm here for any non-Grizabella vote. My goal is to have her not be leading and enough people to eventually get a different version of the show produced.
Hey, let's start talking to producers tomorrow.
That's my goal. My goal, again, I'm going to say it every time to end these episodes, just so if I say it enough, I'm hoping I can manifest it into reality. But I want an Edwin Drew style regional production. I want an audience vote and a different cat every night based on who brought it that night or whatever the crowd interprets as their old Deuteronomy decision. And it's totally possible.
And we have to write the remix of Memory for every different cat style.
I don't think you have to, because I think you can still get all the way to Memory. And then when you have the receiving line, you just pause, because she can still have the redemption arc, bring her back and just welcome her to the family. She mm-hmm. doesn't have to be the choice at that point. She can just be welcomed back and you can still have the same story. But then at that point, then you turn to the audience and say, who should go to? Now, I think Grizabella will still get a good amount of votes because an audience is going to have just heard Memory. Someone's going to have just belted Memory beautifully, I'm sure. And so there is that lasting impression. But I do treat this like an X Factor or American Idol. And yeah, the person who ends the show usually does well, but someone might have brought it in the third or fourth spot too, or their family and friends just might be in the crowd that night. And so they're going to get the vote. And I want that to happen. And it's totally possible. We have the technology. We can strap a different person each night onto that. It's doable. I just need somebody to buy into the reimagined cats.
Well, I cannot wait to see your version of cats.
Yeah. I can't do anything else to produce it. I couldn't tell you what Copeland looks like. I've heard the name. I couldn't help anybody cast it. I couldn't sing it, but I have that one part. I can help figure out that one piece.
That's great.
Well, this has been super fun. How can people stay in touch with you, keep up with all the stuff you're doing?
You can find me on Instagram at Michael Fatica. That's M-I-C-H-A-E-L, F as in Frank, A-T-I-C-A. I'm the most active there, so I'd say find me there.
Awesome. And we'll link to how to go see Spamalot. If you're in the city in New York, definitely go see it. It is an absolute blast of a time. And now you know which cat is which character, so you're going to be ready to go. And we have an Easter egg to go find that 8 count of Copeland during the Broadway song. You're going to have to go find that now. I'm going to have to come back to see it just to see that moment.
We'll just get everyone in the show who knows cats to do something for you.
Try to get, if I come back, I want you to get Alex too to do a cats themed improv for that for one night.
Great.
We're going to make it. I love it. This has been so fun. So thank you for being an amazing guest.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks everyone else for listening to this episode of The Wrong Cat Died, the podcast breakdown of the cat catastrophe. To follow along, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else as a podcast. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and Threads at The Wrong Cat Died, or check out our website, thewrongcatdied.com.
Have you ever wondered how your favorite performer actually feels? Well, here's your chance. Welcome to The Quiet Part Out Loud with me, Bobby Steggert, Broadway actor, and now a therapist to a whole host of Broadway creatives. Part interview, part therapy, this is not your typical podcast. We'll go right to the heart of things with some of your favorite artists, what they still struggle with, what lessons they've learned, what they haven't figured out yet. There's enormous power in saying the quiet part out loud. Are you listening?
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheatre.org. That's theater with an RiseTheatre.org, because only together we rise.